Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Megan LaBrice, editor-at-large of Kirkus Reviews. Welcome to another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us. My guest this week is New York Times book critic Dwight Garner, author of Garner's Quotations, A Modern Miscellany, out now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. This ain't no Bartlett's Familiar Quotations, baby. Oh, no. But it is a selection of quotations, good and strange and meaty and expletive-riddled quotations, that Garner's been jotting down since the 1990s. As the keeper of a commonplace book through high school and his early career as an alt-weekly arts editor in Vermont, as the founding books editor of Salon and editor of the New York Times Book Review, he has amassed quite a quote collection, of which Garner's Quotations represents a small slice of the very best bon mot. Eschewing bromides in favor of witticisms and japes and poetry from books and movies and television, rap songs, and the Paris Review, this uncommon commonplace book is a pleasing and peculiar measure of a literary life. As Ernest Gaines, in Terry McDonald's The Accidental Life, once said, quote, "One way of measuring a life, maybe as good a method as any other, is on the basis of how much peculiarity you have helped to generate," end quote. Listener, I got it from Garner's. Let me read you a little bit of our admiring review. Quote, "From a prodigious list of writers, the index comprises 20 pages, from Edward Abbey to Emile Zola. Garner offers a collage of aphorisms, sometimes surprising, often entertaining. While the quotations do speak to one another, they also leap oddly from topic to topic," which is true. Okay, dot, 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 dot. "Garner delights in including words not printable in his newspaper, and his selections privilege the sly and irreverent. A diverting trove of witty remarks," end quote. After this brief indie interview, I'll be talking with Dwight Garner, author of Garner's Quotations, A Modern Miscellany.
Author Mark John Terranova's novel, Gemini Ascending, Tempting Eternity, reckons with chaotic worlds. He envisioned this book as a modern-day Game of Thrones with a strong current social message. Kirkus Reviews' verdict? Get it. Our reviewer calls it a captivating, otherworldly sequel and says the story triumphantly fuses fantasy with real-world relationships. You can find Gemini Ascending online at Amazon, Walmart, Apple, and Barnes & Noble in ebook, paperback, and hardcover.
Welcome, Dwight, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Megan.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. How are you doing, apart from the end of liberal capitalist democracy?
You're quoting my book? I think that's the second quote in it, or third. I can't remember which.
Second.
Allie Smith, right? Yeah.
Yeah, Allie Smith. Good memory, as advertised. It's funny. That makes me think of that scene in When Harry Met Sally. No one's ever quoted me back to me before.
Yeah, it's one of the. It's a sick habit. Once you sort of start writing down quotes, they kind of stick in your brain, and they come to mind all day long, and it's actually really annoying sometimes. Or at least I annoy other people. Let's put it that way.
So, how often do you find yourself thinking in quotations?
All the time. I mean, literally, anything that happens during the day, I probably have read something that applies to it. I just try to keep my mouth shut, lest my wife hit me in the face, you know. But sometimes they're applicable. I mean, sometimes it's nice to have a reference to the use of a lime or what someone did with a penny or you know, almost anything. But I'm aware that I don't want to be a quote bore, you know, and those people are out there.
Sure, but surely you're not among them. I'm just realizing that my question to you almost read kind of like, do you often find yourself thinking in quotations? Kind of like the lead into one of those designer drugs on TV. Ask your doctor about Quotibolex. So, how did you ever manage to choose epigraphs for this book?
Oh, there were so many to choose from. I mean, I could have plucked other ones, but I don't know. I like the one. It's the Margaret Drabble one about, you know, I can't remember it exactly, but about being one of the benefits of a good education is you start thinking in quotations, which is true. You read enough, and you know, someone like me and someone like you who basically read all day. You know, if you have any kind of memory, this stuff kind of starts to accumulate.
Yeah. And the second epigraph, the primary object of a student of literature is to be delighted, Lord David Cecil. I agree. You know, that's been my whole guiding principle.
Yeah. I mean, I think a critic's first job or any writer's really first job is to, on some level, delight. And I mean that in a very broad sense. I don't mean be charming or be lightweight. I just mean you want to hold a reader and you want to hold them with your intelligence. I personally like prose that is at least somewhat witty. And, you know, a critic like myself who has to write for a demanding audience all the time doesn't want to wear out his or her welcome. And part of that, not wearing out the welcome, is being reliably, at least a little bit, you know, fun to read, a little bit, hopefully, charming and witty.
Oh, you're very fun to read. In fact, I have to thank you for helping me to lose 65 pounds.
I wish I could take that advice. Tell me.
I didn't think I would bring this up in conversation because I don't like to talk about myself very much. But I think it was the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, you wrote a review of Timothy Ferris's The 4-Hour Body that I found so hilarious. I read it aloud to my friends.
Well, I hope you didn't start weighing your own poop, which is what he does.
No. And I still, you know, I'm working on holding my breath for underwater for 5 minutes. Not quite there yet. But they entreated me to download the book onto my Kindle and read from the book itself because it is so funny. And while we were backpacking around Southeast Asia, I was like, you know, there's not much dairy here. And this seems doable. And I lost 65 pounds.
Well, congratulations.
So
Jesus Christ. I'm going to go back and read that review again because, you know, because, you know, I was in West Virginia for a year and I love my home state, but the bread there is not the best. And so I've moved now to Provincetown on Cape Cod. And the bread here is so good that I've just had a carb pig out for the last 6 weeks. So I'm going to go back and read that review.
I mean, don't we all deserve it? The review has a line in it that's something along the lines of there's an act of ventriloquism where you're like, dude, if you follow my rules, you may one day be able to touch the hem of my Speedo. I haven't read it in years, but thank you, Dwight.
Thank you.
Now, back to business. That's a little too much pleasure. When you first started keeping a commonplace book, was the idea, I am keeping a commonplace book, or did the term come later? Did the framework come later?
That's a really good question. I've never really thought about that. I just realized at some point, I was a pretty big reader from the time I was young, and in sometime in high school, you know, I was reading stuff, and I sort of liked some passages. And you know, when you're young and a little bit pretentious, which I surely was, the stuff you're attracted to is all the really awful stuff. You know, it's like, you know, from Love Story, you know, love means never having to say you're sorry kind of shit, you know,
and right.
Or, you know, love is a battlefield. That's Pat Benatar. But, you know, you're attracted to this kind of stuff that feels so true, man, you know, and so
yo.
And so, you know, I wouldn't want to really see the first things I wrote down in my commonplace book. But increasingly, you know, Pauline Kael climbed in there and Jack Kerouac and Joan Didion, and it got better, you know, and I started over time became more, I hate this word, but I'm going to use it, more of a connoisseur of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because I really prize writers who use quotes well, and I hate writers who use quotes shittily. You know, I don't like it when I'm reading someone use the same old stuff. You know, they quote Abraham Lincoln or Tocqueville, or, you know, even God forbid, I love Fran Lebowitz, but she's been overquoted. Mm. So I like it when people do it well, and I sort of look for that. People just like, I hate to say this, but people just don't have a lot of taste for good quotations. I mean, if you ever read books on a Kindle, which I do a fair amount, they show you as you read what the most underlined passages are. And I'm always like, good God, like that's the thing you want to underline? Like, you know, it's like, you know, the rain filled my soul. And I don't know. It's always, even in a good novel, it's like the worst line in it. And I just, I don't know. I want to break our sense of what a good quote is or something. I don't know.
The rain filled my soul. It must have its own Instagram account with like 100 million followers. And it's just a repetition of that quote, you know, over a floral background, you know?
I feel the same way when I walk into a bookstore. You know, they're all, I mean, you know, I love buying book swag. You know, I have a lot of bookstore coffee mugs and all that kind of crap, you know, and tote bags. And whenever I walk into a bookstore and I see these t-shirts and mugs with literary slogans on them, I'm like, that's the best you can do? I mean, you know, let's up our game a little bit with these favorite quotations.
You write in this book, in the preface, commonplace books are not so uncommon. Who kept them? And furthermore, who kept them well?
Well, I mean, you know, the notion of a commonplace book goes back to when books were very scarce and very dear indeed, and you might only get to have a book. There might be one copy that would circulate, and you would have it for a week, and then it was being passed on. And so in order to have something to read, you would write things down. And that was sort of the beginning of the notion of a commonplace book, because books were just scarce. You know, but over time, a lot of people have kept them. I mean, you know, Virginia Woolf kept one. E.M. Forster kept one. The poet Robert McClatchy kept one. Auden kept one. You know, some of my favorite commonplace books, and I've collected a fair number by now, are from people you've never heard of, just sort of witty Brits, a lot of them, who publish these slim little books, and they're kind of become cult items.
Okay, I'm glad you said witty Brits. First of all, how do you pronounce A-U-B-E-R-O-N? Oberon? Aubryn?
Oh, Aubryn Waugh, known as Braun to his friends, of which I was not one, alas, because he's hilarious.
Yeah, I want to know, like, who is this guy? Tell me more, and why does he merit multiple entries in this book?
Well, he's Evelyn Waugh's son, and he ran a literary magazine called the Literary Review in London. He was also a columnist for The Spectator, kind of a clubby guy, a jolly old soul who drank too much and wrote wine columns, and it was just a noted wit, you know. And he published a diary that ran in the Spectator. I think it moved around from various magazines. It was just so goddamn funny. I picked it up for the first time maybe 2 years ago. I actually had a friend, this is a sidebar, but I had a friend who after college worked for Waugh a little bit at his magazine. This is probably in the 80s. But I read his diaries, and he's one of the funniest people I've ever read in my entire life. And I say that with the caveat that he was an equal opportunity offender. I mean, he's pretty damn racist, at least for us today. Mm. But the only thing I will say in his defense is that he sort of hates everyone. He's just a practiced misanthrope.
Right.
But he, I mean, you know, he hates himself. I mean, he hates everybody. But he's one of the funniest writers I've ever read.
This is my first introduction to him. And thanks to you, I think I'm now obsessed. And speaking of sidebars, if you would please indulge me with the promise that this gets back around to quotations, if I may. This is from the career section of Oberon Waugh's Wikipedia page. During his national service, he was commissioned into the Royal Horse Guards and served in Cyprus, where he was almost killed in a machine gun accident. Annoyed by a fault in the machine gun on his armored car, which he drove frequently, he seized the end of the barrel and shook it, accidentally triggering the mechanism so that the gun fired several bullets through his chest. As a result of his injuries, he lost his spleen, one lung, several ribs, and a finger, and suffered from pain and recurring infections for the rest of his life. While lying on the ground waiting for an ambulance, he said to his platoon sergeant, quote, "Kiss me, Chudley," a humorous reference to the dying words of the great Admiral Nelson. He later recalled that, quote, "Chudley did not recognize the allusion and from then on treated me with extreme caution."
That's totally great. That's totally great. You know, Waugh, he wrote a lot. He wrote some novels. He wrote a memoir. He wrote a book about his father. Anyway, there's a lot of him out there to be read. And I you know, with certain caveats, I mean, I think he's just a really funny guy.
You say that you keep categories of quotations. What are some of the categories?
Well, you know, a lot of them are the typical ones, you know, work, love, that kind of thing. But, you know, I like to move into areas people don't always keep quotes about, you know, vomit, masturbation, hatred, lust, revenge, you know, because like I said, I'm just a little tired of all the quotes being about happiness and you know, life is like a box of chocolates. So, you know, I mean, social class, conversation, arguments, editors, publishing, writing, poetry, I mean, really, you know, far flung shit, you know, I mean, just, you know, it's a lot. But I actually prize the weirder categories more than I like the ones that are about happiness.
Vomit is one that recurs, I've seen.
Oh, yeah, I've got some good vomit quotes in this book. I'm proud of my vomit selection. I am, you know, I think it takes art to be a good you know, surveyor of vomit literature. I once called Otesha Mosfeg, whom I love, think like the poet laureate of vomiting. I think I said it better than that in print, but... Yeah, her character is really upchuck or up swallow, someone said, which I really like. Up swallow really well.
Oh man, she blows my mind.
Yeah, she's the best.
Yeah, I was really happy to see her quoted in here. I mean, you've also displayed an apparent affection for Eve Babbitt's.
Oh, God. Eve is my favorite. And I can't believe she just was so unknown for, I mean, I guess she was known back in the day, but she disappeared for two or three decades. And she's always hilarious. And smart. I mean, I'm just, you know, when I say things are witty, I mean, you know, I think there's like some soul to her quotations in writing. And I say, I make this book sound like fun, but this book is also in large part about self-loathing. I mean, I have a lot of stuff in here about just sort of hating yourself. There's a lot of stuff in here about suicide. And I'm drawn to the former, not the latter, I hope. But
me too.
Yeah. Anyway.
I mean, you know, like we started with the Smith quote, you know, it's not exactly easy breezy, beautiful.
Right. Right.
Speaking of book swag and Babbitts, did you ever get your hands on one of those Sex and Rage tote bags they issued
no.
a few years back?
God damn it.
Shit. If I ever find mine, I'll send it to you.
I got about
you deserve it more than, I do.
Well, thank you.
So we've got Babbitts, Dorothy Parker, Kevin Young. Love.
Yeah, I love Kevin Young. I'm not so proud of Dorothy Parker only because she's one of those figures who's just quoted far too often. But, you know, you can't really avoid Dorothy Parker. I mean, she is really, her stuff holds up. Kevin Young is increasingly, you know, I mean, if not my favorite poet, one of the poets I really like the most. And the reason I like him so much is that he's so earthy. I mean, he's smart and has a lot to say, but there's always food in his poems and always drink in his poems and always sort of like fucking and always, he's just really sort of alive. And, you know, he's easy to quote on many different topics because he, you know, he's not one of these poets who stands on Olympus and sheds angel fluff. You know, he's really down in the stuff of life. And he was fun to quote in this book.
I'm interviewing him next week. Do you want to sign on?
he's got a new book, that collection he did. Sounds great.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yep.
Okay, going on. Zadie Smith, Toni Morrison, Colson Whitehead. Kate Christensen, surprised and happy to see.
Yeah, I got her uttering the C word. I've got a long C word section in this book.
You sure do.
Yeah.
Right, no, what to you is the particular allure of a quotation that showcases expletives?
Oh, I quote Whitman in my introduction as saying, you know, for God's sakes, let's get rid of these. I forget what the phrase is, but, you know, gloved gentleman language. Let's have words that talk like we talk, you know, in quotations in literature. So I kind of really went for that in this book. And, you know, I hope it works. But I felt like we needed the kinds of things that don't make the normal books of quotations that are actually really things that are really well said and sort of just excellent.
I mean, excellent and also has a swear in it. At least one of the Brian Washington quotes I saw. I loved Memorial this year.
Yeah, I have not read his novel. I love the stories a lot, but I have not had a chance to catch up with him.
Clear your afternoon. It'll wreck you. And you've got one of my favorite quotes of all time and a favorite of my mother's before me. The only thing I could think of was turkey neck and turkey gizzards, and I felt very depressed. Of course, that's Esther Greenwood on seeing her first penis in Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar. Thank you for that, Dwight.
Yeah, well, thanks, Sylvia Plath. There's a lot of Plath in this book. She's good, and she's good on puking, too. I mean, you know, she said something like, there's nothing like puking with someone to turn you into old friends.
Yeah, I love that one. And a lot of people don't know how good she is on, you know, bodily fluids.
Yeah. Yeah. She was a big, she's really good on, I'm writing a new book now about food and literature. And she will be a big presence in it because she has a lot to say, including just, you know, hating it. I mean, God spare me from cooking three meals a day, she said, but she also was sort of into it, you know?
Yeah, I feel that. Can I ask you about Chuck Berry's autobiography? Like, what riches?
It's one of the best books ever written, and I can't believe it's out of print, which is just incredible. And I was really upset because I wrote a piece in the time, I had this series I did for a while called American Beauties, in which I wrote about an older book that I thought people should you know, be reminded of. And I wrote about Chuck Berry's autobiography, hoping someone would bring it back into print, and it never happened. And I just can't believe, and as a matter of fact, I somehow lost my copy, and I had to go and buy another copy for this new thing I'm working on. And they're really expensive now because, you know, they're hard to find. I had to pay like $40 for it. It really pissed me off.
Man, that, I mean, you know, let's put a call out.
I did somebody. That to myself.
Oh, God. Oh, also, the real Frank Zappa book. That is when I knew that we would get along.
You know, thank you for that. Actually, that quote comes from a friend of mine.
Really?
I did not take many quotes from other people at all. People didn't send them to me or anything. But I have a friend who does keep a commonplace book. And that Zappa quote was one he really loved.
Oh, God.
And so, yeah, it's a good one.
That book is bananas. Okay, so that one you came in. a lot of these quotes obviously come from books. You say they come from other sources as well. Could you just like enumerate, you know, where are these quotes coming from?
Oh, there's song lyrics in there. There's some stuff from movies. I'm trying to think what else. Plays. But I don't know. You know, one is like, you know, Jim Comey saying, Lordy, I hope there are tapes, you know. And I use that, you know, speaking about Trump, and I use that in regards to wishing that, as someone said, wishing that history were wired for sound. You know, Dickens and some other writers described bands in their novels, bands that sound outrageous, like screaming locomotive bands, you know, and what did these bands sound like? And we're never going to know. And it's just a tragedy.
Right. There are some really clever juxtapositions in this book, because as you mentioned in the preface as well, you know, these are all taken out of context. Like, so we get a quote from Jane Austen about balls. And where you've placed it, I think, I mean, I don't know that she would have put it there.
Yeah, that was probably a bit mischievous of me, I will admit. But it is followed up by a Joan Jett quote saying, girls have balls, they're just higher up.
It kind of gave me a double take. I had to like go, you got me. Oh, I honestly, full disclosure, I read the first 150 pages of this book straight through, and then I began to hallucinate that I was you.
Oh, God. Well, you shouldn't do that. I mean, eating, first of all, you don't want to be me. Re, the self-loathing part of this book. But B, you can't really read this book. You can't really gulp it, because it's like eating pickled onions or something. You know, it's like, it's too much. I don't know. You start to feel, even you know, I can't really reread it now. It's a little too much for me, but it's like eating pate or something, you know. It's,
yeah.
Give me a little bit, or like a pile of kidneys or something. Anyway.
Yeah, honestly. Oh, my God. Okay, what else do I want to ask you, Dwight? I mean, I feel like we've been chugging along so splendidly. Michel de Montaigne. I quote others in order to better express myself, Montaigne wrote, and compared quoting well to arranging other people's flowers. He was kind of like... There's somebody who's really good at incorporating a quote into their writing.
Yeah. You know, I said I really respect writers who do it. And it's such a fine art, because you can't bludgeon the reader. I mean, the quotes, they just can't stand out. I mean, you don't want to, they don't want to be like the avocado pit in your dish. They want to be, you know, a little bit of the avocado, you know. And so the art of using quotes well, and so many writers, even novelists do. One thing I love about Sigrid Nunez is that in her novels, she it's full of literary references and quotations, but she's so gentle with them. You know, she'll be writing about a cat or a dog, and she'll just say, like, you know, just along, just in passing, that, you know, X writer kept 9 cats, or Y writer, like, you know, drop kicked a cat through the goalposts, or, you know, but she does it in this very gentle way. And you don't feel like, oh, look at me quoting someone. It's just part of the way she thinks. It's part of her mental process. And, you know, I hope that I can learn to do that in my reviews. I mean, I've been accused of overquoting, and I know that I have at times. I'm trying to reform myself. There is a quote in this book from, I think it's from Cocteau, who says something like, whatever they criticize you for, intensify it. So I sometimes think about that.
Yeah, and incidentally, Nunez is the absolute best person to sit next to on a bench at a literary party.
Ooh, I'm jealous.
Withering.
That's one of the drawbacks of being a critic, is you can't go out anymore. You know, I you have to become an agoraphobe, because it just does you no good to meet people. You know, if I met Sigrid Nunez and we really hit it off, well, then I couldn't write about her. And also, if I hated her, I couldn't write about her. So, it's a bummer. I was an editor for a long time at the Times Book Review. And back then, it was just, you know, I edited people, and I just go out for drinks, you know, but those days are gone.
Oh, those halcyon days, Dwight. Back to Montaigne. I happen to know a Montaigne quote, and it's, but they do not wear breeches. And I mean, it's from On Cannibals, but I was also thinking, if we were going to, you know, like, place it like the jewel it is amidst, you know, a collection of quotations, maybe it could go in the Zoom meeting category.
Oh, God.
You know?
No one pull a tube in here.
No.
Yeah, there are pants quotes in my book, you know, Frank O'Hara, you know, when you wear pants, you want them to be tight enough so everyone wants to sleep with you, I think is how he put it. So, yeah, I mean, see, I can just do this, and it's like a really bad party trick, and I want to knock it off.
I'm into it. I'm here for the party. And I'm wondering now, glancing at the time, do you have a good quote for like wrapping up a podcast recording?
Well, maybe, because I think my favorite quote in the entire book, I think, is Cy Twombly, of course, the Southern artist, who was quoted by Sally Mann in her biography, in her memoir, excuse me. He describes death as, quote, closing the bodega down for real. Life's a bodega. Actually, Seymour Crimm in my book says he refers to his brain as this profuse upstairs delicatessen of mine, and which kind of chimes with the closing down the bodega. So let's close down this bodega.
Let's close down this bodega. Dwight Garner, thank you so much for joining me today on Fully Booked.
That was fun. Thanks, Megan.
And if you would indulge me, just one more quote before we hit the road. Quote, the ending should fall off the tree like a ripe pear, end quote. That's from Andrew Lytle in a letter to Harry Cruz. And that's from Garner's Quotations. I was speaking with Dwight Garner, New York Times book critic and author of Garner's Quotations, A Modern Miscellany, out now from Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. After the break, we'll ask our editors for their top picks in books for the week.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
We're joined now by our editors with their top picks in books for the week. We have Young Readers editors Vicky Smith and Laura Simeon, nonfiction editor Eric Liebetrau, and fiction editor Lori Muchnick. Starting with Young Readers Literature, Vicky, what's your choice for us?
My choice for the week is a book called Exploring the Elements, A Complete Guide to the Periodic Table. It's by Isabel Thomas and illustrated by Sarah Gillingham. It is absolutely beautiful, which is perhaps not the first adjective you would think of about a book about the periodic table. But
yeah,
when the book was pitched to Laura and me, I said, ooh, can I take it? And Laura said, sure. I had no idea you were so excited about the elements. And the elements are important. I acknowledge that they are useful and I encounter them all the time. But what I was so excited about is the design of this book makes it just gorgeous to use. The pages are laid out in these very neat grids. The color contrasts are startling and exciting. The graphic images are they're sort of like what you'd see on a poster. They're very eye-catching. And so it makes picking up all this information just sheer delight. And I don't want to oversell the beauty of the book without talking a little bit about how, you know, there's a lot of information in it too. You just open up to any spread. Most elements are given an entire spread, and you know, it gives you the basic information about the element, like lithium is the lightest metal, and then it talks about how lithium is used, where you might find it, what the atomic structure is. In that, you know, just the picture of the atom is another thing of beauty. It's, for instance, lithium is a key component in electric car batteries, which I did not know this contain about 9 pounds of lithium. Most lithium is extracted from salty lakes. Scientists are finding out how to extract it from seawater. Around 220 billion tons of lithium are dissolved in the world's oceans. So, you know, the book is really good at giving you a sense of how each element works or does not work within our daily lives. And also when you start thinking, oh my God, that's a lot of lithium and we're going to run out of salty lakes, she's terrific about saying, yes, and here is more possibility. You know, so it is really conscious of sort of conservation and use as well, and sort of the future of the element and how likely it is to be sustainable. I mean, and the whole thing is just super exciting. And although I was not very excited about the elements when I grabbed this book because I was really more interested in the graphics, now I actually kind of am excited about the elements. Our reviewer said, could make a chemist out of anyone. I'm not sure that's totally true because I'm not a chemist yet, but it's really exciting.
That's funny. You couldn't make it. I don't know if it'll make a chemist out of me because I was awful at chemistry, but I love the fact that you described it as beautiful, because I think if a book like this existed when I was younger, I would have had much more interest in the elements. And I'm also glad that it's, you know, it shows the practicality of these things. I hated the periodic table because it was just dry, and at least the way I was taught it. So the idea that it shows, you know, the elements' significant forms and what you said about lithium. And also at the end, I noticed the reviewer noted something about, you know, some of the elements that are, you know, very scarce and are extremely useful in things like phones, and how, you know, I've done a little reading about how there are so many of these newer elements that are required in all this technology, and a lot of it is running out. So I'm glad they addressed that as well.
Yeah, they totally do. And I guess I should have been a little bit more straightforward about that. It doesn't promise that our lives are going to continue on unchanged forever, but it is really, I think, good at contextualizing without making you feel like, you know, we're entering the elemental apocalypse.
So. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So nobody came to this with a favorite element, but Vicky, is it lithium now? Do you have a favorite element?
Oh, it depends which page I'm looking at, because actually they all are gorgeous and exciting.
me personally, I'm a neon gal.
I like neon.
Number 10. Where number 10? Okay. The book is called Exploring the Elements, A Complete Guide to the Periodic Table. It's by Isabel Thomas and illustrated by Sarah Gillingham. Thank you, Vicky, for that choice. Next, we have Laura. Laura, what have you chosen for us?
So I have chosen a fantasy called The Way Back, and it's by Gabrielle Sabat. And it's set in 19th century Eastern Europe. It's a Jewish village called Tupik, and it focuses on our two main characters. There's a boy called Yehuda and a girl named Bluma. And death is personified, and death is wandering through their village with, you know, the consequence you might expect. And through a series of events, the two of them end up separately wandering through a cemetery near the village and into the far country, capitalized far country. And there are demons, there are spirits, there's a very rich Jewish cultural element woven throughout the book. I would say if you like Neil Gaiman, this is a book for you. And it's also a book that Vicky is extremely enthusiastic and waiting to say wonderful things about. And I'll just say, pick it up. It's just like from the first page, the writing is just gorgeous and the world building, and it just draws you right in.
This is one of my absolute favorite books of the year, and I was so excited that I had a chance to read it. I actually read it last summer, and they kept on pushing back the publication date, so I've had to hold off from talking about it for really a lot longer than I like. But it is stunning. I just want to read a couple of paragraphs to give you a sense of how gorgeous it is. One of the secondary characters is a Rebbe, who is just the holiest man around, and you get a sense of how holy he is in this little bit. The long fingers of death caught on the hem of the Rebbe's prayer shawl, and he fell. Until this moment, the wind, as a mark of respect, had observed the custom of parting on either side of the holy Rebbe, but now, as if crying out in grief, the full force of its strength went tearing indiscriminately through Zubinsk, and as the five young Hasidim dashed forward to catch their Rebbe, the gale tore screaming past them on every side. So, you know, on a sentence level, it's fabulous. As Laura said, the world building is great, and everything she said, magnified by 10, I'd say. But one of the other things that's really, really exciting about it to me is that it's incredibly Jewish, but it does not have Jewish suffering at its center, which is not to say it's an easy book. There is, you know, when death is a prominent character, you're not going to have an easy read. But Jewish persecution isn't part of this story. And how often do you see that in books for young people and books for older people? Some of you may have a better sense than I do, but it was so refreshing to read a book that was so incredibly rooted in the culture, that didn't have pogroms, didn't have the Holocaust, didn't have the Inquisition. It was just this incredibly rich, textured fantasy.
The title is The Way Back by Gabrielle Sabat. Thank you, Laura, for that pick. Next, we have nonfiction. Eric, what's your choice?
My choice is a book by the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo. It's called American Crisis: Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic. And it's basically like a kind of a journal of how he handled the pandemic, and especially about how he constantly battled with national leadership, especially the White House, and how he kind of got through those things and was able to handle the crisis about as well as any place in the country. And it's just it's a very liberal book for sure. Our reviewer said it shows a record of how to and how not to manage a crisis. So I think we've seen a lot of books about COVID-19 for sure. I'm about sick of them, but this one is just a great picture of leadership, what leadership looks like, how to handle something as unprecedented as this virus and handle it well.
I'm super curious about looking at this book, Eric, because, you know, as somebody who lived through the worst of the pandemic in New York in March and April, you know, I think Cuomo definitely did a better job than our national leadership, but there is plenty of blame to lay at his feet. And he's kind of created this myth of himself as the super leader. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he was sort of busy feuding with the mayor of New York City in a way that wasn't helpful because he has this political chip on his shoulder, and also, you know, made a really bad decision about people who lived in nursing homes who got COVID, who went to the hospital, and then he made the decision to send them back to the nursing homes when they got out of the hospital. So there was like a lot of bad decision-making going on. So I'm very curious to see how he is going to spin that, or if he just ignores it.
And he's fairly honest, but you're right about that. I think what he shows the most is what the magnitude of what the inept federal response did to people at the state level, and basically made it nearly impossible to get things done as well as they could have been done. Basically, his thing was that he, unlike Trump and the administration, they basically didn't abandon his role of governing. And while he may have made mistakes, he actually was there and making an attempt and doing what he thought was best.
Eric, do you know if there's an audiobook on this and if he reads it?
I do not know. I'm not sure about that, but my guess is he might.
I don't usually go in for audiobooks, but his accent soothes me. You know, it sounds like my family, you know. So the title of Eric's pick is American Crisis: Leadership Lessons from the COVID-19 Pandemic by Andrew Cuomo. Thank you, Eric, for that pick. And finally, we have Fiction with Lori. Lori, what have you chosen for us this week?
This week, I have a first novel called Memorial by Brian Washington, who I know you interviewed and really loved, right?
Yeah.
This is his first novel, but it's not his first book. He had a book of wonderful short stories called Lot that came out last year. Memorial is about a mixed race couple, Benson and Mike, who live in Houston. And the book is divided. Two sections are told in the first person by Benson and one section by Mike. And when the book starts, they're kind of drifting apart. They've been together for a while, but their relationship is sort of fading out. And then Mike, whose parents were Japanese immigrants who have moved back to Tokyo, leaving him in Houston, he hears that his father is dying in Tokyo, and he decides to fly back to spend some time with his father, from whom he has been estranged, just at the same time that his mother, did I mention that they're divorced? His parents are divorced. His mother is flying to Houston to visit him. So his mother arrives. Mike leaves her with Benson in their apartment in Houston. He flies back to Tokyo. And then, you know, we hear these first person sections from each of their perspectives. So here's Benson, a gay African-American man living in an apartment with his Japanese boyfriend's mother, who is, you know, none too happy to be left by her son alone. So we kind of see what goes on with them. And then we see how Mike is dealing with his homophobic father back in Tokyo. His father runs a bar, a late night bar, and Mike comes in and starts helping him out there. And, you know, kind of we see how he is fitting into his father's relationships with the other people that work there and the customers and various people. So these are all just really deep and conflicted and interesting relationships that are just different from lots of other books. You know, you're lover's mother, who you don't really know, is stuck in an apartment with you. That's not really a relationship we've read about before. They're just so intriguing and well-written and just a lovely, wonderful book.
Laurie, it's a funny coincidence you picked this one to talk about because I recently downloaded it, the audiobook, and I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. And I wanted to recommend a read alike. It's the graphic novel. It's a 2-volume set, My Brother's Husband by Gengoro Tagame and translated by Anne Ishii. And so it's a similar story, but from a Japanese perspective. And it's about this Japanese man who's a single dad, and his twin brother had gone to Canada and married a white Canadian man. And then the twin brother died, and the Japanese man has a surprise when his brother-in-law shows up on his doorstep to visit. And he has to, it's this journey of, you know, he's being hospitable, he takes him in, and then has to deal with his own kind of his grief and regrets over how he treated his brother, his internalized homophobia, and then also the message he's sending his daughter about, you know, how we treat family, how we think about sexuality, all these things. And they're really sweet, charming, lovely books. They're great for teens and adults. They're written for adults by a gay Japanese graphic novelist, but great for teen readers too.
Sound great. The other thing that I don't have a similar book, but I think I told you about it. After I read this book, I started watching a TV show that to me really almost shed light backward on the book. It's called Midnight Diner, and it's a Japanese show shown on Netflix, I think with subtitles. And it's set in this little diner, which, you know, I couldn't really picture what Mike's father's bar looked like until I saw this show, which was just, you know, like set in this late night diner where the same regulars come in and sit at the bar all the time and talk to the chef behind the counter. And that's very much, I think, what this bar looked like. So it was fun to read this and then watch that show and have them reflect on each other.
Yeah, I've put that on my watch list after you recommended it, but haven't seen that yet either.
Laurie's pick for the week, and one of my favorite books of the year, is Memorial by Brian Washington. Thank you very much for highlighting that, Laurie. Well, that does it for another episode of Fully Booked. Thank you all so much for joining us. Please join us again next week when my guest will be Meryl Marco, an Emmy winner multiple times over, TV comedy writer, best known probably for working with David Letterman. She is the author of the graphic memoir We Saw Scenery, The Early Diaries of Meryl Marco. It is, when I say graphic memoir, I mean illustrated more than explicit, but we'll find out more about it then. You won't want to miss it. Till then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.